We've only just started, just opened the door. Look, now's the time to go through that door and find what lies beyond it. Why, don't you see, Paul? We've discovered the source of life itself, and we've used it to restore a creature that was dead. Now, this is a tremendous discovery, but we mustn't share it yet.
Welcome, everyone, to Hooked on Horror's brand new podcast, Hooked on Hammer, where we'll be looking into the wonderful world of Hammer Horror. I'm Adam. I basically started Hooked on Horror in 2015. I essentially run it. I'm not going to bore you with the details. If you do want to read any more about Hooked on Horror, me or anyone else in Hooked on Horror, just head to the About section of the website. So yeah, this is our first podcast. I'm really excited to finally be getting going on this. I know we've been saying about it for a while, but yeah, here we go. And obviously joining me for my podcast, because it's very boring just to listen to one person for an hour and a half, is Mike.
Sharing your enthusiasm, sharing your excitement as well.
Yeah.
Definitely going to be putting in more of an effort than I do with the content that I put on the website.
Well, I bloody hope so, Mike, let's be honest.
Well, we'll see how we go. I'm hoping to share some of my knowledge and my passion for Hammer through the years, and really excited to what we're going to watch.
Okay then, let's get into it. Cue the footsteps.
Dracula, and I welcome you to my house.
In the name of God, you dare not!
This is more than a superstition, I know. The danger is very real.
It's a criminal lunatic. He tried to kill you.
We've discovered the source of life itself, and we've used it to restore a creature that was dead.
It begins. Come on.
So getting straight into it, Hammer Films started in November 1934, actually one of the oldest film companies to exist, Mike.
I mean, it's recognised as one of the oldest film institutions around the world, if you include things like Universal and Columbia as well.
Yeah.
Universal being 1912 and then Columbia 1918,
yeah.
This one of course 1934. It's amazing, not only as a British institution, but a worldwide institution for film.
Yeah, 100%.
And of course, when you're looking at Hammer, you've got the different periods
yeah.
that came out of it. 1934 to approximately 1937, 1938 is its first foray into this new boom in the British film industry.
Yeah.
From about 1938 till about 1955, it's where they really dip their toes into different multifaceted films, different genres such as comedies, dramas, and then, of course, going into the Cold War with...
Cold Mass Experiment?
That's the one.
Yeah, it's a great film, to be fair. It is a very good film. And obviously, that was highly successful, and nobody was really expecting that. So obviously, off the back of the success of the Quartermass Experiment, we had our first Frankenstein film from Hammer Horror, which is the film we're going to be focusing on for this podcast, which is the 1957, if my research guides me correctly.
More than 100 years ago, in a mountain village in Switzerland, lived a man whose strange experiments with the dead have since become a legend. A legend that is still told with horror the world over.
We've only just started, just opened the door. Look, now's the time to go through that door and find what lies beyond it. But don't you see, Paul? We've discovered the source of life itself, and we've used it to restore a creature that was dead.
This is Frankenstein, who revolted against nature, who experimented with the devil and was forever cursed.
There was, obviously, that was, a lot of people say it was the start of the Hammer Horror films.
Michael Guerreras was quoted in saying, it started the cycle, it started Hammer. What we now see as the horror identity, this is where the foundations were laid.
Yeah, I can see that, to be fair. And obviously on top of that, it was the first... And it was the first colour Frankenstein. Was it the first colour horror, period?
I can't say for sure if it was the first ever colour horror film. It was definitely one of the first British Technicolour horror films that was made. for distribution worldwide as well as within Britain. And of course, we talked before, outside of the podcast, about people still using black and white, such as Hitchcock with Psycho.
Yeah.
But then we have the other British horror film from 1960, which was in colour, which is Peeping Tom.
Look out! Look out! Look out! Take care. You are being watched.
Oh, yeah, I didn't forget about that.
You would.
Well, arguably one of the first slasher films to put the audience in the killer's perspective.
Yep, definitely. Yeah.
Anyway, not getting too sidetracked.
Yeah, going on to Psycho and Peeping Tom. Here for Frankenstein.
So, yeah, no, we are here for Frankenstein. Who isn't here for Frankenstein? Like, what a film.
Yeah, like, what a story.
Yeah, obviously came out after the Universal one, so obviously people had their expectations at first. For me, personally, this might sound slightly controversial, I don't know, but I actually preferred this to the Universal one. It was more macabre, a lot darker than the Universal one. So yeah, like, I just much preferred it to the Universal one.
I completely agree. As much as I love
Karloff.
Yeah, Karloff, James Whale's direction, using German expressionist techniques.
Yeah.
I have an affinity of love for the 1931 Frankenstein. But for me, it's gotta be that gothic romance.
It isn't,
comes
just
from 1957.
There's just something different. It just hits differently, the Hammer films do, than the Universal ones. I think they were more out there to push the boundaries a bit more.
Yeah. If we look at it from a classification or censorship point of view, as a film as a whole, rather than aspects of the film, the 1931 version of Frankenstein definitely pushes the boundaries of what could be shown on screen. There's the big hoorah around the removal of certain dialogue from the 1931 film.
Which dialogue was that?
So Colin Clive as Henry Frankenstein admits to knowing how it feels to be God.
It's alive! In the name of God! Now I know what it feels like to be God!
So they removed the dialogue from there because that's blasphemous. That was before the Hays Code. It was more to do with guidance that films had to follow, particularly with the MPAA, and then, of course, the BBFC, the British Board of Film Censorship at the time.
Yeah.
The 1957, the Terence Fisher Curse of Frankenstein, of course, pushed boundaries with what it was showing, rather than saying.
Yeah,
it was definitely what it showed.
They definitely showed a hell of a lot more than the Universal adaptation did. Like, you don't see him beheading a corpse or anything in the Universal version of the film, do you? You get, like, implications of it, but this one, they don't shy away from it at all.
No. No, and it is one of the scenes that we'll talk about later on. It's not even a scene, it's a shot that was removed specifically by the BBFC.
I think I know the shot you're on about.
Unfortunately, it's been not really remastered because it was taken from VHS copies, but put back into the film for later releases on Blu-ray. So now we get the full scene with this specific shot.
So what was your first experience with The Curse of Frankenstein then, Mike?
When I started my physical media collection, I started with the Universal horror films.
Well, how long have you been collecting now then? Go on.
Since about 2002.
Honestly, folks, I'm sat in a room now. It is impressive. I thought I had a lot of DVDs and memorabilia, shall I say. Yeah, Mike's on another level. It's impressive, I'm not going to lie.
It's only about 2,700.
Only?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I wish I was richer. I'd get a lot more. But actually, my Universal collection, which was released in the mid-2000s, it started off with the horror films, so the Frankenstein films as well as the sequels.
The classics.
Yeah, the Draculas, the Wolfmans, everything was part of that collection. And it was only when I went online to look for more sequels to the Universal horror films, so the Abbott and Costello on-off sequel, unofficial sequel.
They were great, to be fair.
Yeah, they were hilarious. I came across something called Frankenstein Flutch. So I bought it. It had a cool picture of some blue man reaching forward with his clawed hand. It was a German copy of The Curse of Frankenstein.
Oh, wow.
That was the first Hammer film With the exception of maybe She, which was on TV and my nan loved it. So I sat there watching through my hands because I was scared.
Standard.
Yeah. But what about you? What was your introduction to Hammer?
Well, my introduction used to have a TV in my room as a kid. I think it was on like Channel 4 or Channel 5, like Friday or Saturday night or something. They used to screen classics. Like, that's the first time I saw one of the Friday the 13th. That's the first time I saw one of the Hammer horror films. First time I saw the Twilight Zone movie and the... Is it something at 30,000 feet? The one with John Lithgow? And I vividly remember watching it, and I clearly shouldn't have been because I was like 8 or 9. And I remember him opening that blind on the plane, and that creature was outside, and I literally just shit myself. Leapt out of bed, running downstairs, straight from mum and dad's, like screaming like a little girl.
Did it scare you because you saw your future?
Anyway, my first Hammer film was The Horror of Dracula, as the US release called it. So Dracula with Christopher Lee. Definitely shouldn't have been watching the film. Again, I was probably like maybe 8 or 9. And that first scene where he comes out and you see him first time as Dracula the Vampire scared the shit out of me. I was gone, like, that was me. Like, just there was an Adam-shaped hole in the door. Let's put it that way. Crying like a little girl to my mum and dad about this horrible, very polite-looking gentleman called Christopher Lee.
Yeah, with blood on his fangs.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, it kind of didn't melt in a little bit, because obviously that was probably my first glimpse of Christopher Lee, and didn't know it was Christopher Lee, obviously, at the time.
Yeah.
So the first thing I remember him being in is Lord of the Rings. Obviously, that was age-appropriate for me. Like, Hammer Horror definitely wasn't. But yeah, I remember watching Lord of the Rings, and I couldn't quite put my finger on it, where I was like, I know him from somewhere, but I don't know where. And it's not until I started going back into horror, then as my teens, like, you know, rediscovering Hammer and actually going through the back catalogue and watching all their greats and, you know, all the other great films that came out in the 70s, 80s, and obviously prior to that, obviously, with the earlier ones from Hammer.
Yeah.
But yeah, they were just fantastic. It was another level. It was... I just remember watching it for the first time, and it scared me to the point that I was like, I'm hungry for more, but I don't know why.
I think it's a good point that you made, that, you know, you started watching them and that they were something different. And it's one of those things, and it's like Carreras had said, you know, this started Hammer. With Hammer in general, you have a certain expectation of what you're going to
definitely
see. The mood, the style, even to the cast and crew.
Yeah.
You expect those people to come back. Very similar to other British institutions like Rank Organisation or Ealing Studios. You've got the same cast of characters in terms of personnel within there. But then the films have that similar theme going through them, the similar mood, the atmosphere. And I think... probably a disagreement here, but my favourite Hammer film of all time is Curse of Frankenstein. And I think it pretty much does lead the way. Like Carreras says, it is the foundation that led to Hammer Horror.
Yeah. No, it's not a controversial point, to be fair. I probably agree with you there. I know we don't agree on a lot, Mike, but you know, this is one of the few we might actually agree on.
This is the one in a thousand.
So obviously, getting into it, not here to talk about ourselves as much as we want to.
Love it.
Here to talk about Terence Fisher's 1957 masterpiece, Curse of Frankenstein.
Before we do.
Oh, great.
Adam.
What?
I have a couple of questions for you.
Why have I got a bad feeling about this?
Question number one, Adam.
Oh, here we go.
How many Frankenstein films were made under the Hammer brand?
You really want to put me on the spot here, don't you?
I do, number two. This film has bookends at the beginning and the end that's around about Frankenstein telling his story. What other Frankenstein film outside of Hammer did that?
I actually hate you.
Question number three and the final question.
Great.
When was the first ever Frankenstein film? Don't worry, Adam. You and the listeners can get back to me at the end of the show.
So before we get into the meat of this film, we need to understand where the bones came from. So, Mike, I think I'm going to give you the lead on this, being as you know a hell of a lot more about it than I do.
Well, one of the things that I do know, I'm a big fan of Amicus, who are a competitive studio to Hammer. It was founded by Max Rosenberg and Milton Sabotsky. And it was actually those two individuals that came to Hammer originally. They went to Michael Carreras and offered up the idea of what they could potentially do with a Frankenstein film.
I do understand, obviously, they went to him, but I know Hammer were kind of forced, legal papers, should we say. Basically, it was a threat from Universal telling them not to copy anything in a 1931 film.
Yeah, yeah.
So, obviously, they brought in Jimmy Sangster and completely rewrote the script, and obviously had Jack Asher shoot it in, I think it's Eastman Technicolor or Eastman Color.
You've got Eastman Color, Eastman Technicolor. It's just a different gradient, and of course they want to try and make it as different as possible to the James Whale films,
yeah,
which were black and white.
One thing I did pick up on this, obviously, when you get into it, the colours in it are just...
They pop.
Oh, massively.
Yeah.
Like, the reds especially, like, you go into the laboratory scenes and... Just, yeah, the colours are very vibrant, they pop, they kind of draw you in, if anything.
I mean, we'll get into it once we get into the film, but
yeah.
I mean, the costumes, the sets, the equipment that they use, different types of, like you say, blood, different liquids that they have in there, just to make it interesting and to separate it from the 1931 iteration.
Yeah.
Without further ado, Adam.
Yeah.
Pass me the marmalade.
Spoiler alert, much like Jesus.
Well, it's been 67 years. If you haven't seen it by now, fuck are you doing?
Yeah, to be fair, I got to kind of agree with that point. If you haven't seen it, because Frankenstein at this point, as much as we want you to listen to the podcast, go away from this podcast, watch The Curse of Frankenstein, and then come back, because we've got some great points coming up.
Yeah.
So, the film starts basically, Baron Frankenstein is in a jail, basically going to retell his story of what the hell happened and how he ended up there, which is, you know, it's a pretty solid opening. It's a good opening for a film.
Yeah, I mean, it's very bleak. One of the interesting things from it is the fact that we enter the jail with a clergyman, a priest, that's been requested by Baron Frankenstein.
Yeah, you don't really expect that in the first, like, the opening scene of a horror film, be honest.
And, I mean, as later events transpire, you don't really expect a man of science to be meeting with a man of faith.
Yeah, that's true. Kind of conflicting ideologies a little bit there, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's poignant, because Baron Frankenstein does specify that the reason he chose a clergyman to be the recipient of his tale, which will be eventually the rest of the film, is because people will believe what he says.
Keep your spiritual comfort for those who think they need it. I sent for you because I could think of nobody else. People trust you. They listen to what you tell them. Now you listen to me. When I've finished, you can pass it on to them, and then perhaps they'll believe me.
And I think, as you say, you know, it's very bleak, it's very dark. He's waiting to be executed.
Well, yeah, he's essentially, that's it, like, you're fucked with a capital.
I mean, he's going to be guillotined. He's not going to be hung. He's not going to be shot by firing squad. He's going to be guillotined.
Yeah, that's a bad way to go.
Yeah, I wouldn't want it.
Personally. Especially, funny fact, I originally this from Nightmare on Elm Street, the brain lives for up to 7 minutes after it goes. So that poor bastard could have seen his stuff. They did say that I did learn something in GCSE history, so I will say thank you to my history teacher and thank you to my biology teacher for that one.
I'm not going to say thanks to anybody because I didn't do too well neither.
I mean, that's why I'm not a doctor, that's why I'm sat here on a podcast, Mike. I wasn't great at science either.
One of the things you've got to point out, though, is the casting of the pivotal role.
Oh, well, obviously, Cushing, just... There's no other way to describe it. I couldn't give you a bad film he's been in. I know he wasn't a massive fan of Star Wars, but he was even good in that.
Princess Leia, before your execution, I would like you to be my guest at a ceremony that will make this battle station operational. No star system will dare oppose the Emperor now.
But this, he was another level. He was just fantastic performance, and even more impressive that this was actually as far as I'm aware, his first feature feature film role, is like lead as a, well, I say his lead as a role, of his role as a lead.
Yeah, so I think he was, bit part in TV shows, the odd TV shows, but primarily in theatre as well.
Wow, okay.
Fantastic man. And, you know, for the rest of the film, it kind of leads up to what type of cast we're going to get.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. So obviously the film goes into Baron Frankenstein talking to, I think it's his auntie, his mother's wake.
Yeah.
And that's when we first get introduced to Elizabeth as well.
Yeah, his cousin.
And then a little back and forth about money, which is obviously granted for back then.
Yeah, and I mean, he's a baron. He's made of it.
So after his auntie and Elizabeth leave, we get introduced to Paul then, which is, he comes in as his tutor.
Yep, and the one thing that I'm going to point out of this is, whilst he walks up to the house, he eyeballs his auntie, knocks on the door, and as the young baron opens the door, he just walks right in. He's a mega Chad.
So, just for our listeners, Mike, what is a Chad? Because I don't, like, I'm not Mr. Current on the kids' terms nowadays. But, you know, what, for our listeners, what would you define as a Chad?
Chad's the alpha, big bollocks in society who thinks he can get all the girls and walk around on all the other people.
Bit of a dick then, basically.
That's Paul.
So anyway, Paul obviously comes in, he gets hired by the Baron.
Yep. Who is the Baron?
Yeah, who is the Baron, obviously, we'll find out afterwards. Then we go from there, obviously, it's... Who was the younger cast member?
It was Melvin Hayes.
That's it. Fantastic performance. And obviously from there we go through a montage of them working together. And obviously that develops, he develops into Peter Cushing then.
Yep. And as much as I love this film, and I'm all about verisimilitude, expanding my disbelief, the one thing that I cannot wrap my brain around,
come on, man,
is how they thought Peter Cushing looked younger than his tutor. I have no words.
I don't know. I'll argue argument for that, because I thought he was younger.
Is it because he had his dyed black hair?
Potentially. No comment on that one.
they gave Paul the grey hair then.
I think it was the facial hair. With Paul, the facial hair.
Oh yeah, because he looking at me confused clean there. Like,
there's no in the film with a mustache. What are you on about, Adam?
I was thinking Peter Cushing with his sideburns.
No, not Wolverine Peter Cushing. No, but obviously goes from there then. And
sorry, I'm just imagining Peter Cushing pouring himself in like the solution in the glass chamber and filling himself with adamantium. And then just breaking out like...
Spoiler alert, folks. Peter Cushing is in Deadpool and Wolverine. He is.
I mean, he was in Rogue One,
yeah,
so...
That's, well, yeah. So from there, we're getting a bit off topic here. I think we need to kind of stick to this. Goes from there, then, obviously, you go into the Baron basically wanting to do this experiment, and they managed to bring a dog back.
Yeah, and I think that is one of the pivotal scenes of the entire film, because we see it's a puppy, and both Paul and Victor revive the puppy through means which are different to the 1931 version.
Yeah.
1931 version, they use lightning. This time, they use... The wind turbine to basically make the electricity through there to bring it back. But it brings back a puppy to make us believe as an audience this is a good thing.
Yeah, that is true. It's it's a very like pivotal scene. You don't really see that in the Universal one, do you?
No, you don't see where he starts.
You just kind of see...
Got to.
Yeah. So, like, for me, like, I see this film, I class this, I put this more as a, like, it's focusing on the Baron as opposed to the monster.
Yeah.
So, like, I put this as, like, a performance piece within horror.
Yeah.
But, yeah, like, this is much more about the Baron's, like, descent into madness, I'd say, as opposed to the actual monster.
And I think, probably something we'll catch up with at the end.
Yeah.
Is that I believe this film does focus on a monster. It's just not
the Frankenstein's monster, is it?
Yeah. It focuses on Victor as the monster.
Oh, 100%. And, you know, as the film kind of goes on, he just progressively
gets...
It is
a descent.
Yeah, he just gets worse and worse and worse.
Yeah.
So obviously, like, they bring the puppy back to life. Mm. What goes on from there, then, Mike? Come on.
So after that, we have that conversation between Paul and Victor. Paul wants to submit the findings to multiple different institutes to say, we have done this.
Yeah.
We've achieved X, Y, and Z. Whereas Victor wants to postpone it, and he wants to push it further. And that will lead to...
Obviously what happens later on in the film.
The rest of the film.
Can't I just skip the... did one animal trial and went straight to the human trials.
Yeah, exactly. They only did it with one animal as well.
Paul, it's alive. Paul, we've done it. Paul, we've done it.
The following scenes in the film follow pretty much every other Frankenstein tale going after the cadaver.
Yeah.
They've explored what they could do. Victor's persistent. He wants to be able to create something from scratch.
Yeah.
So the first thing to do is find the bulk, find the body.
Yeah.
Whereas in the 1931 film, which opens up with Henry Frankenstein and Fritz digging in the graveyard.
Yeah, you kind of go straight into it, don't you?
Yeah. It's very bleak. They're hiding from the undertakers, the grave diggers, and they're opening up the grave. This one, straight away they're finding the latest person who's been hung.
Yeah, it's a difficult one. Like, don't get me wrong, the Universal one was, well, you know, it's classic horror. That's it. It's a pinnacle. But this is why I think this one trumps the Universal one. You see this in a lot more explicit detail.
Yeah.
And you just don't see it in the Universal films. It's another level in this. It's kind of just like the norm for Baron Frankenstein.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think it's a lot darker in this film than it is in the 1931 version, but it's very similar to the Kenneth Branagh film in the 90s, is that you know how this person died. You know they got hung.
It wasn't a nice death. Like,
no, they are... Well, the nooses they had on the street were for strangulation, not for neck breaking.
Yeah.
So they suffocated. It was a horrible, excruciating death. What pushes it over the edge is Victor's comment about the crows eating the eyes and taking the eyes.
Well, the birds didn't waste much time, did they? The eyes. Half the head's eaten away. What are you going to do?
Take the head off. It's no use to me anyway.
Like, even now, like, I rewatched it obviously before we recorded this, and even now I was a bit like, ugh. just taken aback a bit by it. As I say, you don't really see it in Universal film, and obviously it goes on later in this film. And he just, like, so blasé about it, just says to Elizabeth, oh, I'm going out for work. Not a problem. Don't worry about it. It's fine. I'm going to pick up a pint of milk. You're going to pick up a pair of fucking eyes.
Yeah.
There's no bringing this down. Like, it is, that is, like, pretty horrific in its own right.
And I think at the point that he goes for the eyes, Elizabeth has come to stay at that point.
Yeah.
She arrives, he's leaving, And it's on a business trip.
Yeah.
He's got his bag, he's got his coat, he's got his hat.
I'm going to say now, I am making quote marks with my little fingers here, and we're saying business trip.
Yeah. Yeah, it was kind of a business.
Well, to be fair, it's his business.
Somebody got paid.
Yeah, you got me there. Yeah. I'll give you that, you got me there.
What do you think, sir? They'll do.
The one thing I will say about that scene where he gets the ice, and I mentioned it whilst laughing, is the guy who's supplying them,
He's so blasé about it.
Yeah, and he's like, oh, yeah, it's so
fine.
Good.
It's fine. Oh, yeah, the crows haven't got to these yet. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's like, dude, these are somebody's eyes you've just taken out of a corpse, like, you know.
Not only that, he's coughing his guts up all over the place. And then he's trying to haggle the price of the eyes. Oh, we said this. No, we didn't. We said this. Oh,
yeah.
All right, then. And then gives him the eyes. No questions asked. Like, Christ, you wouldn't be able to do that now.
Well, I'd imagine like there's a bit more at least bartering involved.
Yeah, and
hopefully
legality.
Yeah, well, you know, Baron Frankenstein's just gone on the black market here, essentially. Well, if you think about it, if you go back all of those years, that would have been their version of the black market, you know, back in Scotland when
Tales of Birkenhead.
Yeah, people sat in corpses and God knows what else and purposely killing people to sell corpses to people. You know, looking at the grand scheme of things, this isn't actually that abnormal.
Is it the first case of organ donor?
I think it might be, actually, Mike. I think it might be.
But it does bring us into the scene, or should I say the shot that I mentioned earlier that was cut originally by the BBFC.
Go on, and let's talk about this then, Mike.
It's particularly with the eyes. It's a close-up of the eyes going into a jar. Of solution.
Yeah.
And then you have the close-up of the beautiful baby blue eyes of Peter Cushing staring at this eye in solution. Which the British Board of Film Classification said, no, you can't have that. Sorry, guys.
To be fair, I kind of like get where they're coming from in that sense.
Well, I mean, in 1957, maybe.
Yeah, well, you put it in the context of things. Like, you know, people may listen to this and be like, eyes in jars, like, oh my god, that was in, like, Sort 2, what are you on about?
Yeah.
But, yeah, in the context of things, like, that would have been quite shocking at the time.
Yeah, I suppose 1957, you know, the casual audience that are going to go see it might not be the best received.
Obviously, like, you're talking about censorship and all that, there's another bit that got cut from the film. The original theatrical release, there was a brief shot, do you know when he cuts the head off and he puts it in acid?
Yeah, because I think that the head is horrendously scarred again from the crows.
Yeah, but that was originally put in the film, and it was cut and replaced with a quick shot of Frankenstein's face bubbling as the sound plays. The BBFC felt this scene was way too morbid, and they asked for it to be cut from the film. Obviously cut in subsequent airings and in cinemas and on television. I don't think it's actually available anymore. From like everything we've looked into on this film before the podcast, everything saying like this shot no longer exists.
What did the shot entail?
The head in the acid bath, just a bit of bubbling basically.
I know,
I think it was just a bit more than what we got in the film.
Yeah, because in the film that we see, especially from the Studio Canal release, we're able to see Frankenstein throw the head into that vat, you know, that bath. And we see it go in.
Yeah.
Or if there was anything more. But it's a very quick shot.
Yeah. But I think, obviously, like, when it comes to classification and that spiel, should we say, there's been countless films where they've asked to cut stuff down and stuff like that. And let's be honest, 99% of the time, it doesn't work and it just shits all over the project.
Yeah.
But, like, in this case, I would say, like, it didn't really have that much of an effect. We still got him stood there cutting.
We got the idea. We knew what was going on. It didn't take anything away from it.
Yeah.
As you said. I mean, it goes with the guidance that's been with the BBSE Yes. Well back then, about what will give offence to a reasonably minded cinema audience. The definition of what is a reasonably minded audience
will change. I was about to ask you to define that.
Yeah, it's going to be different, and it's going to be different through time. Yeah. Like you said earlier about context, it's all about the context of what's going on. We see, you know, the three separate additions to the body. Yeah. Be done the hands from a European pianist that had died a couple of weeks before. We see the eyes being purchased. We don't see them being implemented, but we see them in the jar. And then, of course, we see the head being taken away, put into the vat, and we know it's replaced with another head.
Yeah.
Which kind of leaves the body with one last addition. It is the brain.
It is the brain. As much as I love this film, I can't bring this up because it comes into my head with every adaptation of Frankenstein when the subject of the brain comes up, and Mike's already laughing because he knows exactly where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
And I hope anyone listening knows where I'm going with this, but when anything comes up with the brain, all I think of is Abby Normal. Like from Young Frankenstein. I can't help it.
Abby someone. Abby who? Abby Normal. Abby Normal.
It's ruined a couple of films for
me. It's definitely ruined. It's ruined a lot of Frankenstein films. It's just too on point.
But it was just perfect comedic timing. Abby? Was. Abby who? Abby Normal.
Abby Normal.
Mike.
Are you saying that I put an abnormal brain into a 7.5-foot-long, 54-inch-wide gorilla?
I think it speaks volumes. Like, everyone goes on about Christopher Lee in this film as the creature. Mm. We don't see him until nearly an hour into the film. Yeah. You literally just see a body under a sheet. That's
it. Yeah. Another reference to a film that came way after this. We see it in the glass container, this rectangular glass container in solution, in mummy wraps.
Are you going to go walkie horror?
But it is, and it's a testament to this film.
Yeah, 100%.
The design of it, like we mentioned very briefly about how they use, is it kinetic energy? How they use that instead of lightning, how they dress the laboratory instead of having the electrodes,
big, wide
the
scale
Jacob
machines,
ladders and stuff going on there. They have more solution-based things.
Yeah.
You know, bright colours all around there, and they have this glass carpet.
It sounds weird, but like you look at a lab and it almost looks like British.
Yeah.
If you get what I mean. Yeah. Like, it's a weird thing to say, but it's like, it looks British in comparison to, like, the Americanized version of Frankenstein, should we say.
And I think with the American one, it's very theatrical.
Yeah.
And this one, again, verisimilitude, it's trying to be based in realism.
Yeah.
So we're looking at test tubes, we're looking at beakers, we're looking at jars, we're looking at all these different things. When you look at the array of apparatus that's there within this laboratory, it's not dissimilar to walking in to a microbiology lab.
Or walking in to your biology class at GCSE with the Bunsen burners. That
we were never allowed Bunsen burners in
my school. Oh, mate. My teacher used to purposely be like, do not turn that gas on. Do not, I will come down and you will light the fire of hell. Do not turn that gas on and get that Bunsen burner going.
Too many people burnt other people in my school, so it was a no-go.
Well, that would be why for you.
Yeah. It wasn't me. I'm just throwing it out there. It wasn't me.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say it might have been you, Mike. I'm not going to lie. I've known you for long enough now.
Prove it.
You don't believe me, do you? You must believe me, do you hear?
And as we said about the scene with the dissolving of the head, it follows into the next conversation between Paul and Victor, following on from the previous one that they had.
Yeah, I think in the film at this point, I think Paul kind of sees that and he's like, yo, I'm out.
Yeah.
I'm done. I'm not doing this shit anymore.
Yeah, he's kind of enabled him up until that point and then just went, no, I'm not doing it.
Yeah, like, you kind of got to give Baron Frankenstein a bit of a break here. I know people are probably listening to this going, what the hell is Adam on about?
Oh, what you're saying is nonsense. A revolt against nature.
You have a guy that's worked with him since he was a child. in that montage, right at the beginning, we see them learn together. The Baron is learning everything from Paul to a point where the Baron is now teaching Paul.
Yeah.
To a point where they resurrect the puppy and then have that disagreement. And now Paul is looking at things ethically.
Yeah. Which obviously, like, Frankenstein, I think you kind of get the feeling from the very beginning. He's a scientist, he's very committed to his work, but he kind of just doesn't know when to call it quits.
Yeah, is this beyond science?
Yeah, like, it goes from that point, this is like, well, okay, this has gone beyond ethical now. This is, frankly, quite unacceptable, what we're doing.
It's very questionable, and Paul, as much as I bang on that, he is the true villain of this film.
The proper Chad.
Yeah, the proper Chad. He is the person who's seeing what they're doing is wrong, but not bringing in the appropriate authorities to it. Whereas the Baron wants to go gung-ho and keep going with this.
Well, this is my argument that obviously we talked about before that, you know, the actual monster of the film is not Frankenstein's monster.
It's Paul.
Personally, I think it's Baron Frankenstein, personally.
I agree.
To an extent. I was waiting for that little bit then. Yeah. And then from there, obviously, we go into him being arranged a marriage, obviously, with his cousin.
Yeah.
That's a little bit dodgy in its own right. Obviously, sign of the times.
Not 1957, but when it set.
Yes, it's 1860 something.
Let's go with that.
It's set in a previous time, ladies and gentlemen. There we go. anyway, even that was a bit like, okay.
I don't think it's the most questionable thing of the film. I'm not condoning it.
I mean, we're talking about beheading people and putting their heads in acid here, so is incest up there? It's probably up there.
I mean, criminally, you get less time. With the betrothal to Elizabeth,
yeah,
it's almost like you think that this is going to dissuade the Baron.
You can't, from you, the plans. Like, kind of hope that, you know, this marriage is going to be, like a lot of our friends, they've gone a little bit off the rails and the missus is going to rein them in, basically.
Yeah. And I think that's part of what Paul's idea is. Although he's very caring towards Elizabeth, you know, the type of guy he is.
Ulterior motives, shall we say.
That's what makes the Baron more dangerous. And the invitation to Professor Bernstein.
Yeah.
The greatest mind in Europe.
You can kind of, like, the second he turns around, obviously, you know, they go about creating their monster or Baron Frankenstein there, and you can kind of get the feeling when he goes on about how great this guy is and you know, the most incredible mind in Europe, and he's, you know, he's the dog shit, basically.
Yeah.
You kind of know, like, you don't have to put one and one two. I'm not the smartest guy alive, Mike. I'm really not. I'm an underachiever, not a moron. You kind of know where he's going from there. You see it in him in Cushing's performance. Yeah.
The setting of it as well, because Paul goes away. And the meeting with Professor Bernstein.
Frankenstein.
Is set for when Paul's away.
And obviously he comes back. Fucks everything up, basically.
Yeah, so another reason to blame Paul for everything.
Well, you can't really blame Paul for coming back when you're, you know, attempting to murder somebody.
Spoiler. 67 years later.
I was going to say, you had to go at everyone earlier for this. So if you're still listening to this and we have spoiled the film for you, well, what have you been doing for the last 67 years?
Yeah. Being born.
This man's raving.
Bringing Bernstein into the house, having that conversation, having Elizabeth be a tool to the conversation to make Professor Bernstein feel comfortable within Victor's presence, giving him the false sense of security, almost making it out that there is no ulterior motive. Of course, he's not going to know there is. He doesn't know what's going on upstairs. Yeah. Neither does Elizabeth, which makes her even more heartbreaking to use her that way.
100%.
It's Victor distancing himself, disassociating from the people around him. Yeah. He's already sent away Paul. He doesn't need to send away Elizabeth. He can use her naivety.
That is true.
And of course, it brings us to the point where Professor Bernstein performs an amazing swanton bomb off the top of a balcony.
That was a great WWF reference.
Yeah. The one thing I will say about that scene, I love Victor stopping the professor and saying, oh,
look at this painting. Picture. Yeah.
Take a step back, it's even better. Take a step back. Professor, look out! And then throwing him off the top of the steel cage.
It's like Mankind and Undertaker all over again.
Watch out, watch out, watch out! He's broken in half!
I would like to show you a painting just before you retire. It's this one at the top of the staircase here. It was purchased by my father and illustrates one of the early operations. If you step back a little, you'll see better. Look out, Professor, look out!
He throws him off the top. He lands skull first onto the ground.
This is where I got into it as well, because obviously we watched it before we did the podcast. Yeah, like when he hits the floor, I was looking at it, I was like, he's definitely like at least a little bit of brain damage.
Yeah.
But yeah, he goes face first, man. Like, he's definitely wrecking his head or his brain, or at least ending up with some sort of a bruise.
It is one of the moments as well that takes me a little bit out of the film, because when he does hit, the impact of it makes the carpet, which should be stone floor, ripple.
Yeah. I picked up on that a bit as well. It's a little bit worse since we've got better copies of it as well.
Yeah, and we can actually see the floor move.
But I'd say you get a lot of British, I wouldn't say films, but sitcoms, that sort of period where you'd have something happen and you'd literally see the wall shake. Somebody slams the door and, you know, it's meant to be just a slam door. You just see the whole back wall shake. Well, I'm just going to say a perfect, I know it's a bit after this film, but a perfect iteration of that is 40 Towers. Just like, those sets were not built to last.
No.
They were barely built to like hold up John Cleese. Let's be honest, like, John Cleese slamming a door and running Manuel's head through a window or anything like that. It's not going to hold up well. That was quite a shocking scene, because for me, obviously, the speech beforehand when...
Professor Bernstein.
That's it. I was... Beinstein. Why the hell did that come into my head? But he goes on record like saying to Frankenstein, like, oh, okay, don't spend all your time up in a laboratory because you're going to alienate your woman and you're going to miss out on all the good things in life. And yet he's like, yeah, I know this, but I'm going to kill you anyway and take your brain.
Yeah. And it's what I said about disassociating, using Elizabeth as the tool, seeing him as...
nothing more than a brain, essentially. Yeah.
and that's it. And Victor keeps bringing the conversation back to his knowledge and his experience and his memory and all these different things. And he's talking to him on an emotional level that Victor just can't...
comprehend.
Yeah, he can't acknowledge it.
Yeah. He's completely shut off, disassociated from everything. He's so engrossed in his work at this point, as creating this, as he sees it, some sort of superhuman being.
Yeah.
That, he's not going to give a shit about anything else.
And I think it is, we said it before about pivotal scenes with the puppy, the conversation between Paul and Victor previously.
Yeah.
This one, again, is a pivotal scene that marks the change in Victor's character. Well, he's no longer a sociopath.
Yeah,
he's now a psychopath.
It's another progression, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, you've gone from a point of being like, okay, I wish I could do this, to be like, oh, fuck, I'm just going to do this. End of story.
Yeah.
Like, whoever...
It's mine to have.
Yeah. Whoever, you know, I've got to go through to get to this, I'll do it.
Yeah. Because previously, we've seen him steal. We've seen him pay. He paid a pretty price for the house. He can't buy the brain. He can't buy the mind. The man is still walking around. Well, he's gone from stealing cadavers to making corpses.
Yeah. If only he had an abnormal brain.
Yeah.
To be honest, let's be honest.
Well, Paul's going to help him with that.
Wow. That goes on to the next thing then, doesn't it? Where, let's be honest, like, Paul's... I'm not defending Frankenstein here. But he's already got the brain. Just leave him alone.
Yeah.
It's already out. He's not going to use it again. Just leave him be.
But again, it's Paul's morals and the ethics behind everything. he knew deep down Victor had something to do with it. Why else would Victor want his body in the family crypt?
Easy access. That's the point. Easy access, isn't it?
And he knew he was down there.
Yeah, 100%.
He went down there, he sees them with the jar and bagging up the brain. The tuffle happens between the two of them, and Paul savagely smashes the jar. He doesn't, Victor accidentally does.
I thought I'd find you here. It was very intelligent of you. Now that you've found me, what do you want?
You killed the old man, didn't you? You killed him, and now you're mutilating his body.
Mutilating? I've removed his brain. Mutilating has nothing to do with it.
I can't prove you murdered him, but I can stop you using his brain.
Why? He has no further use for it.
Don't be a... Be careful! You damaged it! Get out! Get away from here! Leave me alone! Get out of here!
And again, it's the difference of where they are now. You know, we saw them where they were before. They were a different intelligence, different mindsets, being a young baron to a Tudor, and now we're seeing them, they were equals, and now they're not.
Yeah. I think, as you said, this is, like, a pinnacle scene, as Frankenstein goes deeper into the craziness, shall we say.
Yeah.
And Paul's more like, okay, I need to deal with this
ethically. He's still grounded in the scientific community, whereas Victor is trying to transcend.
100%. From there, then, we go into Paul warning Elizabeth about everything that's going on.
Yeah.
And he thinks, obviously, she should just leave, get up and go, just drop everything, leave. And then we go into a pretty macabre scene, to say the least.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's different, isn't it? We don't usually see somebody pulling glass from any organ, let alone a brain.
Not in that time period, no. Anyway.
No.
I mean, like, it may have boded well for the Saw filmmakers in Saw 3, but that is light years away from 1957, should we say.
We didn't even see the full creation of the monster in the 31 film, or the full creation of the bride in 1935.
Holy shit, we didn't, did we?
No. Not one bit. So this is pretty much, we're watching him piece the puzzle together.
Yeah. Never really thought of it like that.
Mm. I have.
Clearly. Baron Frankenstein's in his laboratory, obviously trying to make the monster, and he's met with the difficult decision. He can't operate the machinery by himself.
Yeah.
So we kind of need to get the Chad back in, basically.
Yeah, the Chad man. And it's one of those things, again, it's all about how it began and where they were. They work together on everything. It's a two-person machine.
But this is why I find this scene so fantastic. It's because, obviously, he goes off, Baron Frankenstein goes off, he's like, oh, I need some help, I can't do this by myself. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, this has already worked. The fucking creature's, like, coming alive.
Yeah, it's done
and
it.
And he's completely and utterly oblivious.
Yeah.
It's just such a fantastic scene. And then when he goes to go back up to the laboratory, he hears the glass smash.
Yeah.
And then you go in, you rush in, and it's just this is wonderful shot when Cushing walks through the door, and it goes past him over the shoulder.
Yeah, it's a brilliant
and it just
crushing.
Stops by there for a brief moment, and Christopher Lee comes up, and obviously pulls the wrap off, and the camera just quickly, it's not a zoom, the camera just quickly just goes forward.
Yeah.
That scared the shit out of me the first time I saw this.
It's such
a powerful scene.
It's like, it's unnerving.
Yeah.
I watched it with my partner. Didn't really get on with the macabre scenes that we have with the body, the different pieces. But this, the suspense of the Baron walking up, the smashing of the glass, knowing the machine started, saw the movement from the monster.
Yeah.
And then, as you said, the door swinging open, that crash zoom into this figure and the placement of it.
Perfect.
For me, it epitomizes the feel of what Hammer Horror is in 100%. One shot. It's colourful, but bleak.
Yeah.
It's
fascinating yet terrifying at the same time.
I was going to say it's beautiful, but macabre. There's nothing beautiful about it, to be fair. but, you know, as you said, Christopher Lee reaches up and pulls the bandage from behind his ear, revealing that face for the first ever time. And this is not Boris Karloff.
No, like, for me, watching that the first time, that for me, I think it was the original Phantom of the Opera, Lon Chaney,
where she pulls the mask off.
He's at the organ and, pulls the mask. It was the same for me. Yeah. When he pulled that rag off, it was like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God.
Because do you remember...
And that's way more horrific than the Universal one.
When Jack Pierce created Boris Karloff's makeup, he spoke to different people and had the assumption that anybody that would have a brain transplant would have a flat top head. Almost like a trapdoor opening up, which is why Karloff's head is flat at the top.
Great design, though, I gotta be fair.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Well, it's iconic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Whereas this one is 20 years later, we've gone through the Second World War where a lot of operations had to go on.
Yeah.
Different type of amputations, different type of skin grafts going on.
Horrendous.
So what we're seeing is the stitch work, but the skin is already dead.
Yeah.
There's no healing for it. So what you're seeing is this grotesque, rotting image in front of you, which Frankenstein immediately sees as beautiful because it's his creation,
isn't it?
But of course, the reception isn't reciprocated because he's then choked.
Well, it's not even like two beats. He pulls the mask off and he's just like...
I'll have you.
Yeah. Say, like, with Karloff's monster, like, you see the opening scene of him and you're kind of like, oh, you know, I feel a little bit sorry for him. Yeah. He doesn't really know what's going on.
Yeah.
This one, it is the polar opposite. You're kind of like, he knows what's going on. He's just going to fuck shit up, basically.
Yeah. It is completely different. When you see Karloff, he's walking backwards through the door.
Yeah.
And then he turns around and you see him with the dropped eyelids.
Yeah.
That big brow going across. And it's almost like there's nothing behind those eyes.
Yeah.
But in the movement, there's something controlling it.
Yeah.
Whereas the makeup and the performance by Christopher Lee as the monster, it's menacing. It's something that shouldn't be.
100%. I think it's like obviously trying to differentiate between the two. As I said, you know, you kind of got a lot more sympathy for Karloff's monster, whereas this one's just, you know, it's the opposite, polar opposite. Like, the makeup on Lee was utterly fantastic. Like, there's no two ways about it. The funny thing is, it was actually last minute.
Oh, really?
Yeah, basically, they made previous attempts to design the monster using plaster of Paris, like some sort of cast for him. They tried doing the makeup off that and obviously failed. Makeup artist Philip Leakey, made the final design literally the day before shooting began, directly onto Christopher Lee's face.
Mm.
He was primarily using cotton and other stuff you find in, like, a house.
Oh, so, like, anything around the house?
Yeah, which is, like, you look at it, that makes it even more impressive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't get me wrong, Karloff is iconic.
Yeah.
Well, you're working with people that have worked with Lon Chaney. Lon Chaney's a man of a thousand faces.
Exactly.
Yeah, they basically did it using household items. Didn't use any latex or molds.
Which is strange when you think.
It's mad.
Most
like,
of the monsters that we see in films, it's a latex mask or a latex mold put over something.
Yeah, or at least like they've taken a cast of them and then like, you know.
So it's reusable.
Yeah, like, well, Freddy Krueger, for example. I know they've got it in, like, original, obviously, was all over the place because they didn't know the ins and outs of it then. But going forward, you had, like, creatures being designed, okay, it's one piece there, two pieces there, like, a back piece, a front piece, a face piece, head force, whatever.
Yeah.
But this was, it was done using household items. Yeah. Like, that is mental when you actually look at it. And it's even more mental the fact that every day when they were shooting, he had to recreate that in almost perfect detail so he didn't fuck up the continuity, but he had to do it every day. Something unheard of in nowadays films.
Yeah. It's definitely going to have a lot of endurance for the actor to be able to do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, a hat tip to Christopher Lee.
Oh, big time. Big time.
Because I think it was between Christopher Lee and Bernard Bresnahl.
Oh, was it?
To play the monster. Creature.
Yeah.
But it all came down to pay, apparently.
Did it?
The story goes that Bernard Bresnahl's agent was contacted.
Yeah.
Asked how much he would cost per day.
I was saying, something like, stupid, was it?
£10, something like that.
Oh, it's obscene. Can't even buy a Freddo for that nowadays.
Yeah, but back then, a Freddo was, I don't know, like a toenail or something. They then contacted Christopher Lee's agent and asked how much he would do it for a day.
£9.50.
£8.
Whoa.
So for the cost of £2,
obscene.
Bernard Bresnahl lost out on a career.
I was going to say career changing. This cemented Lee as a great.
Well, he was then in Hammer. He was in that community, like we said earlier about Ealing and Rank and all these different things.
So essentially, like getting in with Tim Burton, you know, you're going to be set for life. Johnny Depp and Adam Bogart.
Like I said, I'm going to work with my ex-wife or my friends or this or that. I think with anybody, I never work with anybody, even my friends, whatever, like, oh, you know, it's not like a party.
One of the things I got to point out about that scene is even though Paul has turned away from the project with the Baron, he hasn't turned away from the man. And this is something very different between the Baron and Paul.
Okay.
The Baron, if you're not with me on this project, you're not with me, you can leave.
Yeah.
So he's turning away from the friendship that they built, the relationship that they had. Whereas Paul doesn't give that up. He immediately runs into that room, wrestles the monster off of the Baron, helps him, and in the background, Christopher Lee face plants the floor, which I thought was hilarious.
To be fair, he took a big knock on the back of the head.
Yeah.
But yeah, he
by the mega chat, Paul.
I did it, Paul.
This thing must be destroyed before it regains consciousness. Do you hear me, Victor?
What, Paul? What did you say?
You must destroy this thing now.
Paul, don't you see? I've succeeded.
Succeeded, yes. Nearly succeeded in getting yourself killed.
Paul and Baron Frankenstein get together. Frankenstein's like, you know, it's just a hiccup in the road, a speed bump, if anything.
Yeah.
Whereas Paul's, we this is not safe, we need to knock this on the head.
Yeah. Basically reiterating everything he said before.
Yeah.
And trying to reason with him.
Yeah.
Which, of course, Baron Frankenstein's, he's okay with. He's like, I'll destroy it afterwards.
Yeah.
You know he's not.
Kind of there.
Yeah.
He'll say enough to get Paul off his back, essentially.
Exactly. Another, you know, look into his character.
Yeah.
You know, being able to manipulate the people around him.
Gaslighting at his finest.
Yeah.
You promised to destroy it, Victor.
Well, I've carried out my research.
But don't you see you've created a monster?
That doesn't matter. I shall operate on the brain tomorrow. It shouldn't take long.
The monster escapes.
Yep. Goes into the woods. We're introduced to the two, not new characters, but two characters.
Yeah.
One of which very reminiscent of the
Bride of Frankenstein.
Yep.
Yeah.
Walking around collecting sticks and twigs, along with, I think it's his grandson.
Yeah.
He calls him Grandpa.
Yeah.
Collecting the sticks with him, kind of reminiscent from the girl from the 1931.
Yeah.
Because it's near a river and near a lake, at one point you kind of make that connection that, it's like the scene with the flowers.
Yeah, you get that feeling it's going to go in the same direction, but it doesn't at all.
No, and it's just another moment where it reaffirms you have seen this before, but you haven't seen this.
Who are you? Tell me who you are. What do you want with me? Can't you see I'm only a poor blind man? I've got nothing for you. I can't harm you.
very bleak, and it looks like it's autumn, but everything's very grey. And when we see Christopher Lee as the monster walking from behind the tree and behind the bushes, it's just a very creepy, very strange, very eerie visual.
It's when he's walking towards the blind guy as well, the hermit, it's very, well, I wouldn't say like intense, but you're like on the edge of your seat, like, oh Christ, what is going to happen?
Yeah, from what we've seen before, it's very welcoming from the 1935 Bride of Frankenstein. It's one of those safe moments that you see that the monster learns humanity.
But this is a wonderful thing about Hammer. It took this moment and just, let's flip it on its head. Let's subvert the shit out of this.
Yeah.
And yeah, you may be expecting this, but we'll give you a little bit of what you're expecting. Yeah. But, you know, we kind of expected, okay, I thought first time watching this, I'm like, okay, he's going to throw the little kid in the river.
Yeah.
It's not. He ends up killing the blind guy.
Yep.
And then you don't see him kill the kid, but you get that lovely moment where, for like you, they don't even find the satchel. You got Baron Frankenstein and Paul walking through the forest, and you literally, it's a really nice shot, and then they're like, oh, we can follow his trail. And you're like, okay, then. You're like, oh, okay, maybe the kid got it. And it's just a very slow pan, and then like a tilt down, and you just see his bag, and it's decimated. And you're like, okay, well, that kid's clearly dead.
Yeah. You wouldn't expect from seeing.
No, God, not. Again, in context of time it was released and everything, you wouldn't see. And now, like, you know, nowadays, you know, 2018 Halloween, you had a kid, Michael Myers, killed when he got his car and he got out the bus and everything.
Yeah.
It's not as a taboo subject as it was back then, shall we say.
I think with those expectations that we have from what we've seen before, I think it's Son of Frankenstein, where they have the young child and it actually bonds a little bit with the monster.
Yeah.
Boris Karloff as the monster. So it's almost like, is this the moment that it learns humanity and shares empathy and grows?
Whereas Hammer just took that and went, no, this is not the opportunity. Nope. He learns this, he's just going to kill the kid.
Yep.
And the man. It's fantastic, I'm not going to lie. It is. Like, it's fantastic. And then obviously you go, when they meet him in the forest.
Yeah, they find him in the forest.
Obviously Paul shoots him, and it was a bit like, well, you've already damaged the brain, Paul. You're not going to help the situation here, are you? Like,
well, all I can say for, you know, our Class A Mega Chad, sharpshooter. Like, he must have been
marksman.
Like, yeah, a marksman or a military field doctor or something that knows about weapons, because the way he aimed that, it was like a second. And then boom, straight through the eye.
No, Paul!
Do you know one of the funny thing about this is, when they did it, Christopher Lee revealed years later that he actually screamed for real because the fake blood went directly into his eye and like partially blinded him. So he like screamed for real. You don't see that coming across in the performance.
No. And you don't hear him scream either. It's silent.
But yeah, what professionalism to the T. Like, to be fair, like, oh, guys, I'm partially blind, but, you know, let's finish a take first.
Yeah, for £8 a day, what do you expect?
£8 a day?
Yeah, he's got to be professional. That's a lot of money.
£8 a day?
Back then it was. You could blind me twice for £8 a day.
£16.
Oh, no, it was £4 each eye.
Each the pair. The pair. Just like you said.
And of course, this then leads to the monster, inverted commas, dying. And then, of course, both Paul and Victor bury the body.
Well, yeah, you know Victor's got an
ulterior motive. He's got an ulterior motive all the way through the film.
Yeah, that's true. But you get, even afterwards, when he goes up to his lab and he speaks to Frankenstein, he's like, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
It's done and dusted, forget it. And then it's just this wonderful bit where Paul leaves the lab and you just see he's already collected the corpse and it's hanging from the lab.
From the hook.
And you're like, mate, you have got no chill. You're just going 100 miles an hour at this.
Yeah, and it's such a grim... Again, we talked about the atmosphere that Hammer produces, that gothic kind of aesthetic with it. You have a corpse hanging from a hook in a cupboard that you're now going to
reanimate
on to bring it back again when you've said you're not.
Yeah. Almost like a slab of meat being hung up in his lab.
Yeah. And that's all he sees her as. It's just parts.
Yeah.
That's it. All parts of that big puzzle that he's making.
As I said, you kind of get the feeling, as I said earlier, you kind of get the feeling he's just somebody who doesn't quite know when to stop.
No.
But I think there's a certain point in this film he's like, I don't care what I need to do.
Yeah.
I'm just going to do it.
He's almost put his foot down on the pedal.
Yeah.
It's hit the metal. And it hit that.
That was a nice one, Mark. Yeah. I'm not going to lie.
It hit that the moment he killed Bernstein. And he hasn't taken the foot off the gas.
Well, he essentially went, as you said, it was another progression for his character. He went from just a grave robber to you're actually murdering people for your science.
Yeah.
Project, essentially.
Exactly. We mentioned earlier about Paul asking him to stop.
Yeah.
Victor saying, I will destroy it after I'm done. But when Eric escapes, Paul said to Frankenstein, I'll go alert the authorities. And Frankenstein says,
oh yeah, he says,
I already have.
Yeah.
Don't worry, they'll meet us there.
And he's just bullshitting him.
Yep.
When they bury the body and then, like, Paul realised he didn't contact the authorities of the town.
No.
He's like, yeah, I can't save you at this point. You've gone too far.
Yeah, you've far gone there.
Yeah.
Biggest problem is, he reanimates him again.
So it wasn't killed.
Oh, it was. At least life had passed from its body. But don't forget, I was the one who put it there in the first place. It was comparatively easy to destroy it. No, wait, Paul.
Character we haven't actually talked about yet.
Yeah, we haven't touched on Justine, have we?
Quite important to talk about her.
Yeah.
For the next...
scene.
Do you want to elaborate on Justine's character?
Well, basically, Justine's been doing the dirty with Baron Frankenstein while he's been betrothed to Elizabeth, and obviously been having an affair with her behind her back.
Yeah.
And there's a pinnacle scene, obviously, after this, where she basically turns around and it's like, well, what are you doing? You're going to marry me or what?
Yeah.
And this just sums up how far Cushing's character has gone. He literally doesn't give a shit about anyone.
No.
That he's like, you think I'm going to marry you?
Oh, Justine, you can serve dinner now.
Just a minute. Is it true?
I beg your pardon.
About you marrying that woman?
Aren't you forgetting yourself?
You promised to marry me. I'm not forgetting that.
Yes, I did.
Don't you laugh at me. Stop it. Stop it, or I'll...
What? What will you do?
I kill you!
You stupid little fool. Did you really think that I'd marry you?
You're hurting.
The class system comes into it massively.
Yep.
Not as prominent in films nowadays, but obviously still an issue.
Yeah, and was always a massive divide within multiple different British institutions.
Massively.
You know, represented in all the different types of films. And this is the hired help.
Yeah.
Like he says, I could spread
I could
a
do
rumor.
Anything, yeah.
Because he holds a position of authority, like he's been doing with Elizabeth, like he did convincing Bernstein, like he did with Paul, he can do what he wants.
Yeah.
He's making his own creation upstairs whilst everybody else is in the house and he doesn't give a flying. So he's sleeping with Justine the maid whilst everybody else is in the house. It's for the time, and if you think about Christianity, if you think about the values within society as well.
Yeah.
Big red flag,
yeah. Essentially. He kind of lures her in, doesn't he, to the room. He kind of sets her off like he knows he's being followed.
Yeah, and allows her to enter the lab.
And you don't really get that. I think it's kind of like innocent at first. You kind of think, oh, he doesn't really know. And then it's that moment that she goes to run out when Frankenstein's monster comes in, obviously. And you just see Baron's hand quickly just grab the door and close it and lock it. And you're like...
And you hear her screaming on the other side.
Yeah. And to make matters worse with Justine, he sent her in there knowing she was pregnant, potentially with his child.
Yeah. Yeah. If she was telling the truth as well. Which I'm not victim blaming or anything.
I didn't think of that.
Because it almost seems when they have that conversation earlier on, it's almost like she's grasping at anything she can.
Clutching at straws, yeah. Essentially.
Is Victor smarter than her to know her own body more than she does? I'm going to say no.
Why choose me as the father? Pick any man in the village. The chances are to be the right one.
She won't think so. Not when I tell her.
This is another thing I wanted to touch on. A lot of people that are fans of the film have debated whether or not she was sexually assaulted before she got killed. Yeah. Me, personally, I don't see it. Just from the pretenses of what happened when he first met the Baron, he just went to kill him.
Yeah,
That's my mentality.
Yeah, I think it's Jonathan Rigby has it in the Hammer and, Horror and Beyond or Hammer and Beyond book.
Yeah,
that touches upon this. I may be mixing it up with another Hammer book that I've read, which is too many. but Jonathan Rigby sticks out in my mind as a reliable source for information for British horror.
Great,
fantastic.
Great author. Fantastic author.
I'm pretty sure it's touched upon in there that there is the assumption.
Yeah.
That it's there. It's up to the audience to make up what happened in that room. Yeah. We just know she's not alive the next day.
A lot like Veronica Cartwright's character in Alien.
That one, I'd argue that there's deleted footage.
Yeah.
Of that, whereas in this,
there's a lot more stuff in Alien, for example.
Yeah.
That is kind of reiterates the point that maybe she was essayed, whereas this doesn't really touch upon it. It kind of gives the implication of it, but I wouldn't say it's blatant.
No, I wouldn't say it was blatant.
But again, that's down to, as you said, that's down to the audience's interpretation of it. Yeah. Censorship might have come into it because what is often in the audience's head is usually a lot worse than what's actually happened.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, that's the big pull with, good example I can think of, that scene in Reservoir Dogs with the ear.
Yeah.
Where he cuts a cop's ear off and the camera just pans up. You know what's happening. Yeah.
You don't see it. It's just implied.
But it's way worse than actually seeing his ear being cut off.
Watching a film in which three women and three men go to a cabin. It's then taken over by some locals, these men.
Yeah.
They take the men out and they kill them. And as they begin grabbing the women, one of them starts taking photographs. The photographs are just snippets of what's going on, but they leave the audio going. And the audio is
so much worse.
So I had to completely skip until the photographs ended, and it went on for about 2 minutes. I had to stop listening because of the sound.
I'd say it's often a lot worse than what you could actually show somebody on screen.
I mean, it's still not fantastic seeing those things.
Oh, 100%.
It's not something we'd wish to want to see.
I'm quite happy seeing, like, you know, Michael Myers slaughter a bunch of teens. I don't really want to see somebody get essayed.
Yeah, I don't want to watch Irreversible again. I think the main thing we have to take from the ending of this scene with Frankenstein smiling on the other side of the door, knowing that he's gotten away with it again, is that he asks for the marmalade to be passed in the next scene.
Like, I can't even deal with this scene. Just sat at breakfast, like, you know, so blasé and so chill, nothing's going on. You just killed someone, or you just left somebody in a room to be killed with somebody by a creature, by something you've created.
Pass the marmalade, would you?
Sorry, what?
Sorry, left field.
Like, are you actually kidding me? It is quite humorous, because you literally just watch and you're like, is he actually just, like, nothing, not a big deal, you just murdered him. You just murdered your second person. and you just,
it would be
the second person. And just so blasé and just so chill about it, it's just such a fantastic scene to follow on from something so horrendous. Yeah. To go into that, it's quite comedic.
But again, I think it just goes to how horrible his character is.
Oh, 100%. At this point, he's nothing more than a narcissistic, manipulative... That was a big word for me, folks. Manipulative,
You did well.
sociopath, basically. Yeah. The more it goes on, the worse he gets.
Yeah. I'm worried about Justin. You know, it's a week since she went away, and we still have no word from her.
I've told you not to worry. I expect some village Lothario eloped with her. She always was a romantic little thing.
We go into the pre-wedding party then between Baron and Elizabeth. Very upper class, very upper hierarchy.
All the families there.
Yeah.
There's that guy who keeps drinking. One glass after the other where he's doing the toast.
It's literally like a 30-second clip and he's just pissed as a fart by the punch bowl. And his missus comes over and she's like, what on earth are you doing? He's like, I'm just practicing my speech. And it's such a great moment.
To the bridesmaids.
What are you gibbering about?
I was just rehearsing my speech, my dear.
Fool. That's not until tomorrow, after the wedding.
Yes, I know, my dear, but these things take time.
Come on. We're going home.
So soon.
Come on.
It puts you on that level, you're like, oh, okay, this is a light-hearted moment, nothing bad's gonna happen here. But then, obviously, wedding party ends.
Yeah.
And...
everyone's gone home.
Everyone's gone home. Paul obviously comes in.
Yeah.
And that's when Elizabeth is like, oh, well, funny enough, he's got something to show you.
Yeah, he's upstairs in his lab. Paul joins him, and then one thing we'll agree is probably the most sympathetic you could feel for this variation of the monster.
Yeah.
That, you know, we haven't had all the way through the film, because every time we've seen the monster.
He's killed someone, essentially.
Yeah, he's like... killed someone, or he's attempted to kill someone.
Yeah.
But at this point, the way Christopher Lee performs that scene, the way Peter Cushing is so dominating, so aggressive, so forceful, he's treating him like a dog.
Yeah, it is basically like watching somebody hurt a dog.
Come on, get up. Now come here. Come on now. Come here.
And Paul even says, that's not a human, that's an animal.
Yeah.
Is this your creature of superior intellect? Your perfect physical being, this animal?
Victor's treating him like a dog, telling him to stand up, sit down, stand up. And you can see him struggling to stand up and he's just getting more and more aggressive.
Yeah.
To a point where the weight just buckles underneath him.
But this is the great thing about Frankenstein's character, is he doesn't take full responsibility for this, because he turns around to Paul and he's like, you're the one that damaged your brain. It's your fault.
You're as much to blame as me.
Yeah, basically.
And yeah, it is him passing the buck, passing the blame, gaslighting. He's not taking ownership. The only thing he's taking ownership for is, I gave him life.
Yeah.
That's it.
Shall I tell you something, Paul? There you see the result of your handiwork as much as mine. Oh, yes. I gave him life. I put a brain in his head. But I chose a good brain, a brilliant one. It was you who damaged it. You who put a bullet in the wretched thing. This is your fault, Paul. Do you understand that? Your fault.
So I think it's a big thing in this scene. Paul turns around and he's like, I'm going to the authorities. This has gone way too far. I think it really shows how low... Baron Frankenstein's son, how depraved he really is. He turns around and he's like, well, if I can't fix his brain, I'll go and get another. And then you're like, oh my God, this guy's just gone.
Yeah.
There's no helping him at this point. There's no telling him to stop.
No. No, and using the threats of you can't win.
Yeah.
You won't win, because if you go to the authorities, if you don't go to the authorities, I'm still going to do this.
Yeah.
Because he believes he can.
This is what makes things even worse. Baron, he turns around, he's like, well, if you won't help me, maybe I'll introduce Elizabeth to the world of science.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, I forgot about dude. That, yeah. Like, that's a woman you're meant to marry. And you're going to say, like, if you don't do this to me, I'm basically going to throw it to the creature like I did my mistress.
Yeah.
Which is so dark.
Yeah. It's a horrible thing. I completely forgot about that. that moment of introducing her to the world of science.
Yeah.
So I warn you, if you tell the authorities, Elizabeth will be the first to suffer.
Very of the time, for the writing in the 50s,
yeah,
and of the time of the 1800s. A woman's brain can't comprehend this.
I know.
Well, that was coming from, you know, Chad Man, so... the real villain.
Is he the real villain, though? Like, come on.
Well, I'll explain. First of all, he barges into the Baron's house and says, I'm your tutor, mate.
I'm your tutor, mate.
Yeah.
Such a Hammer horror film.
Yeah. Then he teaches him everything. You know, the Baron's got to learn these sociopathic traits from somewhere. And he's only been exposed to the Chad Man. Then he's there, gaslighting him all the way through, turning around and saying, oh, yeah, let's bring back this puppy. Oh, isn't this great? We've brought life together. Yeah, let's do this. Oh, I don't know about doing this. Oh, you were wrong for thinking this. Oh, you're going a bit far now, aren't you, mate? Oh, yeah, you have done pretty good work. No, we can't do that. Shoots the guy with marksman precision, damaging the brain that he's already participated in damaging. And all the while, he's trying to hook up with Elizabeth. We haven't even got to the ending scene where he finally does. The real villain.
I'm kind of speechless right now, I'm not going to lie.
Maybe I watched the film wrong.
Perhaps. Isn't, you know, you're not meant to watch Star Wars and identify with Darth Vader. Isn't
That's that... why I'm not identifying with Paul.
From there, goes into, obviously, the final scene of the film, the climax on the roof.
Yeah, because the monster escapes again.
Yeah, for brute strength, to be fair,
yeah,
you know, you'd think they put two and two together and attach him more with a
chain.
Yeah.
You'd think men of science, you know, men who, you know, look at scenarios and situations and see every possible outcome, they might have seen this coming. Again, I mean, Paul did, because Paul sees everything, apparently.
You're really not a fan of Paul, are you?
No.
I'd like to take this moment on the Hooked on Power podcast to apologise to that actor personally.
Oh, the actor was great. He made me hate the character.
I mean, yeah, job well done then, to be fair, no?
Yeah. Oh, how marvellous to see you.
Elizabeth.
We thought you weren't coming.
Why, you look wonderful.
The creature kind of stalking Elizabeth because she goes up when... Baron runs after Paul when he walks out to go and after the authorities. Him, yeah, what an ending. Kind of wasn't expecting it at all.
I mean, it's not even the ending. It's kind of like the first ending. It's like the Return of the King. Multiple endings. It's the ending of his story to the priest.
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah. Going up with a rifle to save Elizabeth.
And after all that... doesn't even end up shooting the monster. He shoots the woman he's meant to marry.
Yeah.
I mean, if you didn't want to marry her, just don't marry her. Yeah. You don't need to shoot her, mate.
Maybe marry Paul.
I think she does, to be fair.
I meant Victor marry Paul. I mean, all the way through, there's those undertones. Their relationship.
But let's be honest, like, those undertones are pretty much present in any Hammer film.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, Christopher Lee's Dracula, for example.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many sexual undertones throughout that entire film.
And I think, with Hammer specifically, those undertones became tones.
Yeah, they were just everywhere. The norm. Yeah, they were just the norm. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a bad thing. They weren't exploiting it or anything, so to speak.
Not at this point.
That comes later.
We see the monster off.
Yeah.
You know, wrestling with Victor, who's a weakling. If it was Paul, it may have been a bit different. He might have shot him in the other eye. You know, with a second to spare. And the monster falls into that bath of acid.
Acid, yeah.
Yeah. And it brings us back to the closing. Well, it brings us back to the opening, which is also the closing. I do admire that Victor was able to grow stubble overnight just by being thrown in jail. Jail changes a man.
This place here changes a man.
Oh yeah, in what way?
I used to be white.
Looking very distraught, and I think he's kind of realised the gravity of his mistakes. But at the same time, he's like, well, if I get Paul to tell him that, you know, I created this guy that came alive and killed everyone,
yeah,
I'll be fine. So he kind of puts his faith in Paul. And this is why I think...
Adam, what does Paul do?
He literally throws him under the bus and condemns him to death.
Gaslight.
Yeah. Returning the favour. Returning the favour, mate.
Paul. Paul, my friend. Tell them, Paul.
Tell them what, Victor?
About him. About the creature I made. Go on, Paul, tell them. You were the only person ever to see him apart from myself and Justine.
The girl you murdered.
But I didn't. That's what I've been saying. It was him. He did it.
Who? Who did it, Victor?
The creature I made.
Denies everything. Yeah. It's like, I got no idea what this guy's on about. He's obviously a lunatic.
And it's definitely a great showcase of Peter Cushing's acting chops.
Oh, 100%. He's fantastic. Dominates the screen.
Yeah.
Like, in those scenes particularly. Yeah.
Where he's now a broken man.
Yeah.
Because he could, and now he can't, and they've taken that away from him. And they're going to take away his life.
I knew Paul wouldn't fail me. He's been a good friend. He'll prove everything I said is true. He knows. Oh, Paul. Paul. Paul, my dear friend, Paul.
There's that one scene at the end where it's literally like a 30-second shot and it's just them walking him to the guillotine.
Yeah.
And like, there's nothing said. There's not a lot done in the scene.
My memory was a lot longer and it felt like when all of the villains in the universe got together to put the Doctor into the Pandorica in Doctor Who. And they're dragging him towards this cell. And he's there saying, please listen to me.
The cracks in time are the work of the Doctor. It is confirmed.
No, not me, the TARDIS. And I'm not in the TARDIS, am I?
Only the Doctor can pilot the TARDIS.
Please, listen to me.
You will be prevented.
Total event collapse. Every sun will supernova at every moment in history. The whole universe will never have existed. Please listen to me.
Seal the Pandorica.
Oh.
And in my head, I remembered Peter Cushing being dragged and him begging them to listen.
Wow, okay.
It's not a Mandela effect. I think I've just combined some of the earlier scenes where he's asking Paul to listen to him and to tell
them
what went on.
He proper loses it at the end, doesn't he? Like, proper, like, grabs him and he's like, call him.
Oh, no, Paul! Paul, you must tell them. You know what's going to happen. Only you can save me. You must tell them. Paul, I'll make you tell them. I'll make you, Paul. Paul, you must tell them, Paul. Paul, you must tell them. Paul. I'm sorry, Paul. But you must tell them. You must save me, Paul. Paul, you've got to save me. Paul.
It's bleak. It's that mood all the way through the film. It started in the jail. It's ending with him going to his execution.
Goes full
everything
circle,
in between, there's very little air. It's very close. You know it's leading to this point in the jail. You just don't know why or how. But everything leading to it, it's got that doom and gloom undertone to it. It's what you come to expect from a Hammer production.
It's another level.
Yeah.
Like, you watch and you just like, crisis. There is no happy ending in any aspect of this story at all.
Oh no, Paul leaves and he meets up with Elizabeth.
Well, there's one happy aspect to the story.
And then I think Paul tells Elizabeth that unfortunately he couldn't do anything, and then they leave.
But then part of me is wondering whether or not like how much he actually told Elizabeth, because all she saw was the Baron like freak out and shoot her.
Yeah, she didn't see the monster.
So she didn't see. Like, she was caught by Frankenstein's monster.
Yeah.
But she didn't actually see the monster.
No.
So, as far as she's concerned, her husband-to-be has just gone up on a rooftop in a wild rage and just shot her.
Or is that what Paul's telling her?
That's the point. That's the point.
There's nothing we can do for him now. I'll take you out.
That one little clip of him walking to the guillotine is incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
And then you don't get anything else. You just get a shot of the guillotine rising up and it's over the credits.
Yeah.
And even when the credits come to their final bit and they cut out, that guillotine has still not dropped.
Yeah.
which, like, I watched it and I'm like, did they leave that out? Like, you know, did they leave it there? And they were like, okay, let's see how this one does, and we'll, you know.
Considering their other studio made multiple sequels with this property, maybe we can.
The sequels, obviously, for me, this Dracula and Curse of the Werewolf and Laurence Olivier are probably the best Hammer have done for me personally. The sequels to this, some of them were good.
Some of them were entertaining.
Shrink from this eye, this all-seeing eye. Hide from these hands, these powerful hands. Run from the horror, the ultimate horror of Frankenstein.
And that's a great thing that we've touched upon already. This wasn't the end for Hammer. This was just the beginning.
Barely scratching the surface.
There are so many sequels within the Frankenstein franchise.
Yeah.
There are other franchises to explore. I'm excited to look at all the different avenues we can go down with this.
Well, saying that, Mike, thank you for listening, folks. And you can tune in to us on the next podcast episode. We'll be delving even further into the wonderful world of Hammer Horror.
Great.
We're going to be exploring the start of one of the other franchises. Not going to give the viewers any clues. There was about a year between the two of them, 1957, 1958.
Yep.
Obviously, follow us on all the socials, Instagram, X, formerly known as Twitter, Facebook. Obviously, our website, www.hook-on-horror.com.
That's a lot of dashes.
I didn't have much of a choice, Mike, I've got to be fair. Anyway, we'll see you next time, folks.
You didn't think I'd let you go yet, Adam. We have answers.
Right, go on then. What was the first question then?
Question number one was, how many Frankenstein films were made under the Hammer brand?
I'm going to go with 7 or 8.
Is it 7 or is it 8, Adam? Do I get phone a friend?
I was going to ask, do I get a 50-50? No. Ask the audience? No.
You don't get anything.
I'm going to say 8.
Correct!
Knew it.
It was 8 films. I'm not going to ask you to list them because we'll probably be visiting them in the future.
Well, we are looking into Hammer Horror.
Question number two! I asked you, what other Frankenstein film has bookends of Frankenstein telling his story? What's your answer?
I kind of hate you for this, because I don't know the answer. That's the worst thing about it. People are probably going to listen to this and be like, why am I listening to somebody like this? But I don't know.
It's fine. You just lost, like, respect points.
I think I've lost about 500,000 followers in the last 10 minutes.
Well, I'll let you know.
Go on then.
It was Kenneth Branagh's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Not gonna lie, Mike. It's not my cup of tea.
Question number three's answer. When was the first Frankenstein film?
Right, I'm gonna go on a limb here. I might be wrong. I really hope I'm not wrong. If I am, I need to do something with my life, seriously. I'd probably say the 31 adaptation.
Well, it was good having you play, Adam. Unfortunately, you're going home with nothing. The first ever documented Frankenstein film was 1910.
Give me a bit of context, man. No, like, what is this film?
It's about 10, 15 minutes long.
Yeah.
And it has Frankenstein creating the monster running amok for a little while, and then it abruptly ends.
What the hell?
It was great.
How have I not heard about this film? Like, who made it? Like, give us a bit of details, because obviously people listening to this are going to be like, what the fuck is Mike on about?
So, like I said, it was about 10, 15 minutes long. It has Dr. Frankenstein creating the monster. The monster looks hideous. It kind of looks like a Lon Chaney style of creature. And it was directed by Cyril Dawley, who also did A Christmas Carol within the same year.
What, as in the Dick... Well, I'm asking it as in the Dickens classic. There's no other...
Yeah,
that is the original one, like. Oh, the Jim Carrey one, you know.
But no, he made 2 adaptations within the same year. Of course, they were both one reelers.
Yeah.
So they only used one reel to make the entire film, which is why it's so short in length, and why quite a lot of the silent films are a lot shorter than, say, like feature films.
Bloody hell, fair play.
Yeah. So yeah, no car, no consolation prize, and lots of respect.
Well, I was about to say to you, this is the reason I've got Mike on the podcast, but you just made me look like an asshole now, so...
We'll see you next time!